I don't know what it was.
Is that a bit loud?
What it was this morning, but I heard these words and I thought it would be a good introduction. The time has come, the walrus said, to talk of many things, of shoes and ships and sealing wax, of cabbages and kings, and why the sea is boiling hot, and whether pigs have wings. Today I would like to share some thoughts about Unitarian Universalism, who we are, and how we come to be a faith tradition, and what that means. And I wonder why sometimes, if you think back maybe a couple years ago, do you remember the movie The Last Temptation of Christ? Mm-hmm. Do you remember that? And the big uproar that caused within the Catholic Church. And I went to see that movie, and I thought, what's the uproar about? You know, really, I didn't see it being that controversial. And then the movie The Passion, that really, I went to a movie, not The Passion movie, and there were all kinds of high school kids out there, and youth groups out there, passing out pamphlets, passionate about that movie, and getting people to come see it. Recently, we had watched the movie The Da Vinci Code, and that was some trouble within the Catholic Church, and people got passionate about that, so much so that when the next one came out, Demons and Angels, it had to get the Pope's approval. Yeah, this one's okay to watch. And I wonder, in Unitarian Universalism, what would get our passion up to go pass out pamphlets to a movie and stand there, or to be so passionate we'd carry signs against some mass media broadcast. You know, what would hit, or in Islamic, the image of Muhammad upsets people so much, and it's not that these are good or bad, it's just that what gets that passion going? What gets that muscle going, and what would it take for Unitarian Universalists to have that kind of passion? Because it's been my experience that we often don't. Things just sometimes slip by us. And I wonder about that. And I'm thinking, maybe it's because we don't know what is really, really central and original to Unitarian Universalism. What is at the heart of who we are as a people? And I would say that those truths, those faith, in today's world, it's really hard to call them faith positions, but those thoughts and that lead to a particular way of life that are particularly Unitarian Universalists are, one, the separation of church and state. As powerful as the Trinity is, Trinitarians, and when you look through history, Unitarians have been burnt, imprisoned, property taken for not believing in the Trinity. I mean, there's a passion to that belief. Okay? As equal as that is to Trinitarians, the separation of church and state is to Unitarian Universalists. They're the same. Two, free assembly. Assembly to gather and talk as you will about what you want to talk about without fear of persecution, imprisonment, or death. Unitarian Universalists. And three, social equality. Now, you might say, wait a minute, Reverend Wilson, these are values and beliefs that are in our culture, and some would say in the Declaration, in the Constitution, in the Bill of Rights, and these have been woven into the fabric of our democracy. How could they be our tenets, Unitarian Universalist, if they're woven into the fabric of the tapestry of our democracy and we're such a small group? We don't want anything culturally. We're always on a bad end culturally. We're called cult because we're so small. We're not like a big dominant group of people. But yet I contend today that indeed these are central to Unitarian Universalist philosophy and faith tradition. In the 1500s, there were wars and religious wars, and religious beliefs were tied in with state beliefs, and the state and religion danced together, and the Catholic Church, the Protestant Church, Calvinists, and Lutherans, when they got together with the state, they killed other people that didn't believe with them. That was the religious wars and what they were about. And that was the norm. That was just going on. But then there came a group of people, Unitarians, that carved out space, that carved out a place for themselves. And they got one of the kings to say, yes, you can have that space. And here's what they fought for: the propagating of freedom of religious thought, the principle of applying reason to interpretation of the scriptures, revelation, and theological matters in general, absolute tolerance of all creeds. We didn't give up creeds at that point, but that absolute tolerance for all creeds, and the struggle for social equality among people. They were against enserfment. I mean, I read that, I was trying to think, okay, what does that mean? You've got people that own the land and own the castles, and you've got all the serfs out there kind of running around, and they were treated horribly. And I think it would be fair to say they were against slavery at that point. That was a form of slavery. I think it's fair to say that. So I think at the core of what it means to be a Unitarian Universalist, there is an attitude that is against slavery, that is against economic oppression. That is at the heart of who we are, and the birthplace of who we are in Poland, the brothers, anti-Trinitarian, Unitarians. All those names were used to call us who we are. And the goal was to maintain that space with those beliefs and to live out that with their family. And so for 80 years, they had that. And then in the mid-1600s, the Jesuits, with the state, took over in Poland and said, no more. And during that time, it was wonderful, you can imagine, because the printing press had been invented, and the Unitarians went crazy with that printing press. Everybody was writing, they were sending this literature out all over the place for 80 years. And the oppressive religions were going, oh my God, they can't be doing that, because as people are reading that, they're becoming free in their mind as we read our principles. Freedom of conscience. That phrase comes from this era of time. And the rest of the religious groups in the states were going, no. And there was even complaint that said that the Unitarian message made the serfs not obedient to their masters. Can you imagine? That's who we are. Not only do we struggle not to be obedient to the masters because we want to be free, but we enlighten others to do the same. That's our form of evangelism. That's what we do. But that was closed down, and that printing press was closed down. But not before that literature, and as they closed down, that community dispersed. Can you imagine, like right now, somebody coming in and saying to you, because of what you believe, in 3 years you've got to move, or be put to death, or you have to believe how we believe? Well, that's what happened to that Unitarian community. And then after a year, they said, no, 2 years. They didn't do the Maxwell Smart thing. They said, no, 3 years, 2 years. They stopped at two. But a lot of those people had to leave. And when they left, they went to places where they were persecuted. They went to Holland. But that literature and that way of knowledge found its way to John Locke. Found its way to Joseph Priestley. as you look back and you look at the history of time, you see these Unitarian Universalist thoughts moving through time in different places. You see them in people writing about them, but they can't grab hold because there's other oppressive voices there. But they're there. So now they become intention, and they can't grab hold. And now we begin to see, if we look through history and look how those thoughts move through history, we see them land in the minds of the people of the colonies from England. We see that thought land in the minds of Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, John Adams, George Washington, Abigail Adams. We see these thoughts landed, and in this place, you didn't have such tyranny set in. And they knew tyranny, and a lot of people say, well, why did the founders put the separation of church and state? And some people, you know, say they didn't. Our founders knew the history of Europe. Our founders knew about the religious wars. Our founders knew about the burning of the witches and religious oppression in the 1600s up in Salem. They were not ignorant of that. So when they had these thoughts in them and they began to craft space for our democracy, that's what our founders did. They crafted a legislative body, a legislative, crafted a boundary-setting legislative group of laws that would create a space for our democracy. That's what they did. It's like we all live in a container or a holding environment. And we have a universe. We have galaxies. We have solar systems. We have planets. Gravity. I mean, there are certain laws that contain everything, and we're all in containers. It's like when these wonderful fourth generation stories of grandchildren. I'll bet you right now there's a space made in those homes where these new babies are coming into that are beautiful, that have wonderful colors, that have all kinds of things in there, and that's going to be the holding environment for that infant, so that infant can grow up and be well and be healthy and eventually contribute to society as an adult. That's all our dreams as parents. So we create a holding environment for this infant. And that holding environment has to be a particular way. It can't be angry. It can't be anxious. And we don't want it to be dull. We want it to be exciting, but we want it to be appropriate. So you can't do the same excitement with a 3- and a 4-year-old, as it did with my son wrestling around, as you can with an infant. So there's an appropriate way to be. So the holding environment has to be fluid. The holding environment has to be dynamic for health. So the founders of this country are creating a holding environment for this democracy. Our democracy. It wasn't just religious freedom that they were concerned about. They were also concerned about political tyranny. So we have the Constitution. We have the Bill of Rights, civil liberties. We have these laws to protect us from that. But that's just two of the legislative processes that we had to protect us from tyranny, the political tyranny, the religious tyranny. Just two. And in that fabric is the faith tradition of Unitarian Universalism. As those that believe in Trinity, the stuff we believe in is woven in a way, I just hate to say it, we won. I feel like Stephen Colbert. You ever watch Stephen Colbert? Yeah, we watch. That's big. There was another boundary-setting process that was going on to protect us from tyranny, and that was economic tyranny. Now, you've heard it say the word corporation is not anywhere in the Constitution, and yes, it is not. It is not in there. And I got this book at home, and it said, it's not lies you were told by Long, but it's another book, False Truths, and it said, it quoted Abraham Lincoln saying something that corporations are beginning to take over the country, and the book says, well, no, there was no such thing as big corporations back then. And I'm going, hello, what do you think the Boston Tea Party was about? The East Indian Corporation, the East Indian Company, the Dutch had a major worldwide corporation, England had a major worldwide corporation. The Boston Tea Party, what that was about was, is that the East Indian Company had so much, at least one third of the tea that Europe could use in a year, stacked up. And they were losing money, but over in the colonies, they smuggled tea from Holland because there was a law they needed to buy from England, but they smuggled it in from Holland and had all kinds of little tea shops. The tea was the big, probably like coffee shops here. People would go into the tea shops and they would talk and they would do that kind of thing. So the East Indian Tea Company said to England, "We're in trouble. Things aren't new, folks. Half the people in Parliament were also stockholders in the East Indian Company." Just true. It's just historical record. So they said, "Take that tea, take it to the colonies and sell it, and you don't have to pay any taxes. But the people that buy the tea are going to have to pay taxes." So that was an aggravating thing right away, starting off. And so they brought the tea to Boston, and they had the mayor of Boston, or the governor, forgive me, one of the other, pick certain people that was going to be the franchises, if you will, that were going to be the distributors of this tea, and they were going to sell it lower than the other tea houses and drive the other people out of business. Does that sound familiar? Up in Port St. Lucie, Ace Hardware was there, and I'd go in there, and I'd talk to the guy that owned it. It was small, and it had three or four people worked in there, college kids mostly, and we got to talking, and I got to know him, and it was nice. The guy lived in my neighborhood. Home Depot comes in, Walmart comes in, he goes out. That's what we're talking about. Except the mayor and the governor, I forget which, chose family members and best friends, and it really ticked a lot of people off, particularly John Hancock. And I often wondered if he'd pick John Hancock, would our country would ever have happened, because he'd have been one of the selected few. I don't know. But that's how it was. And so to say that the founders did not understand economic tyranny by major, large, worldwide, transnational corporation is absurd, because they did. And their concern was that we do not create a country that did not set up monopolies. That was the word that was used at that time. We don't want monopolies. So you had the founders setting up a container that dealt with religious tyranny, political tyranny, and economic tyranny. For example, in a book called Gangs of America, which is kind of tilts the guy's hand because he's talking about corporations, there's a list of laws for corporations pre-1960 and post-1900. So there's a 40-year gap in there, which a lot of things happened in there. Their concern was so intense that they left the incorporation and chartering of corporations up to states. It had to be local. They wanted the corporation to be anchored locally, and the state legislature had control. And when Madison suggested a few things to make federal incorporation for federal things like canals and stuff like that, the state said, no, state legislature has control. We don't want to get rid of the corporations. We want to use the corporations for the public good. So they had to be local. Many of them couldn't operate out of the state they were. They all had to be, most of them had to be time limited. We're going to do this project for 10 years. We're going to do this project for 5 years. After that, their charter was gone. So in this container, we've got boundaries around oppressive religious institutions. We've got boundaries that will help us fight back against political oppression. We've got boundaries around large businesses that tend to be monopolistic. Here's the difference between the laws. This author calls classic corporation pre-1860, modern corporation post-1900. At the birth, the classic corporation, it's difficult to get a charter, and it's issued by the state legislature. That was part of the holding tank. That was part of the container so that we could have our democracy. These aren't just laws for corporations. These aren't just boundaries for corporations for the sake of boundaries. These aren't just law and boundaries around religious institutions for the sake of boundaries and laws. These aren't just laws and boundaries for political process for no reason. These are boundaries and laws to create space for a representational democracy. That's what they're for. So when I read here, it's like taking it out of context, but when I read here, we can also say this with certainty, that in order to maintain our democracy, we need to make sure that corporations are chartered by the state legislature and controlled locally. Otherwise, our democracy has got a weak life. Lifespan. Corporations are limited. In order for our... Because they have seen... Because the English East India Company, Dusty, they were hundreds of years old. They were 1600, they were formed. 1601, they were formed. And here they were giving the colonies trouble in 1776, 1740, and 1800. They were already hundreds of years old. They said no to that because they saw the damage. Time limited. In order for our democracy to survive, these beasts that can become 200-300 years old need to be time limited for the tapestry and the fabric of this container that's going to allow this democracy to come. And I, you know, I've got to think about that word tolerance and Unitarian Universalism. I think it may be better to say, and I think the same is true for democracy, it may be better to say that we create space so that people can become. That's what we do. We create space so that who I am and who you are, that you can become who you are. That there's not oppressive forces on you, manipulating you to become other than who you are. Now, how old is Aesop's Fables?
2,500 years.
Was that not what that was about? Right? The donkey trying to become the dog, don't be who you're not. Mobility, usually restricted to home state. Modern corporation, no restrictions. Adaptability, restricted to activities specified in the charter. Today, allowed to pursue multiple lines of business. Conscience, actions constrained to shareholder liability and threat of charter revocation. There wasn't any limited liability. You know what limited liability is? If we get together and incorporate, I got my personal belongings over here. If the corporation sets your house on fire, my personal life's not. The corporation, if the corporation goes bankrupt, hopefully we had a liberal enough government to create a fund to take care of that because they know businesses would back out, such as the retirement fund. That's another story. Okay. But no. But in the classic corporation, the corporation the founder said yes to, there was no such thing as limited liability. If you're ever talking to people that use the Bible as their sacred text. In the book of Deuteronomy, where it has all the laws listed, if you look at them, it's just like a list of laws. If you do this, then this. If you do this, then this. If your ox does this, treads on somebody's fence, kills somebody something, you're responsible over here. No place in that sacred text is there room for limited liability. Limited liability is not in the Christian or Jewish faith tradition. It's other than that. So if you say you're a biblical believer, but you're a hardcore limited liability, you're not going to find that in your sacred text. So we created this term at the church up north, where I did. It's called NBC. Non-biblical Christians. But it's true, isn't it? So this is one of them. You've got a Christian who's a fighter for limited liability. It's not in there. There's another economic way in there. You're responsible for what you do. You're responsible for what your pet does. You're responsible for your property and how it interacts with other people's property. That's in there, but not limited liability. Will. And also, the shareholders could be taken to task if the corporation did something wrong. So you know the shareholders were involved in the management of that company, because if that company did something wrong, the shareholders would be responsible. So there was a tight bond between shareholders and managers. The modern corporation? Some CEOs are sending spies to shareholder meetings to find out what's going on in the shareholder meeting so the CEOs can subvert anything that's going to go in there that they don't like. I'm not making that up. There's not that tight bond. And size. There's a limited charter restrictions to the size of corporations. Today, what are the top money entities, including countries, in the top 10? What, six are corporations? Five are corporations? More money than countries? All these laws and legislations and boundaries were created for our democracy. In that democracy, the tapestry of that fabric, we can see the Unitarian Universalist faith tradition. Separation of church and state. Freedom of assembly. How many of your hearts twisted when people that were protesting or carrying signs in Boston during the Republican, or it could be Democratic, Republican presidential campaign of Bush, were put into a fenced arena with barbed wire called a free speech zone? You remember that? I mean, not that long ago. Well, I'm not saying Democrats wouldn't do that, because this isn't about that good or bad. This is about the container of our democracy. That's what this is about. By 1890, that was gone. I realized that when I was saying I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, when I was in elementary school, I was pledging allegiance to a myth that existed from 1776 to 1855. That America that I had in my mind was really about democracy and freedom and creating a space so that who was ever in that space could become whoever they are. That's my America. That's what I was pledging allegiance to. That's my sense of Unitarian Universalism. That's what I'm about when I come to church at a Unitarian Universalist church. We create a space so that we can become, because we have faith that what is in us is good. We have faith that in our freedom, that what comes from us would be healthy for ourselves and bring kindness to one another, so that we create a space so that we can become, so we're not intruded upon and impinged upon, and there's not an intrusiveness that comes in and aggravates us, so that when I express myself, I do harm to others because there's an itch inside of me I can't get to, and I've got to express it somehow. That's not what we're about. That America was then. It's not my America today. 2 months ago, no, January 10th, I think it was, there was a Supreme Court decision made that was the summary or the conclusion or the fruit of a tree that was birthed in 1886, giving corporations constitutional rights as people. Now, a lot of Supreme Court judges I listen to, they say they're constitutionalists. They go back to the original and they're going to stay with the Constitution. But they also affirm corporate personhood. That means corporations have rights as people. That corporation, when we look at a corporation, that's a person according to the law. And you're a person according to the law. Even though you have equal say in our society, for election say, it's not equal. Here's $1 billion here. I don't have $1 billion to do that. So January 10th, the Supreme Court said corporations are people and they have unrestricted freedom to spend money on elections any way they want because they're persons. Now, if you're sitting back, what are you doing? What's the big deal? Corporations, persons. If you go back to the founding of this country and you look at the legislative processes and you look at the philosophy and you look at the thinking of the founders who created a space so that this democracy could exist, if you understood that clearly and really and thickly understood that, you would be horrified at that decision
that was made, I believe, January 10th. Horrified, because that's the end of that space that was created by the founders of this nation. So whatever passion the Muslims, the Christians, have that drive them to movie theaters, drive them into the streets to carry signs because they feel their faith is offended. In January, when the Supreme Court made that decision, our faith was offended.